From grocery store shelves to gym culture, protein seems to be everywhere right now. Touted as a muscle builder, a weight loss tool, an anti-aging solution, a catch-all fix. It's a trend that caught the attention of Queen's University kinesiology and health sciences professor Dr. Samantha King while at a gym here in Kingston, sparking a deeper look into how protein became such a cultural powerhouse. That curiosity led to her new book, Protein: The Making of a Nutritional Superstar. Co-written with Gavin Whedon, associate professor of sport, health, and the body at Nottingham Trent University in the United Kingdom. The book traces protein's rise from a scientific concept to a marketing phenomenon, investigating how its popularity has been shaped as much by industry, culture, and identity as by actual nutritional need. Dr. King sat down with CFRC to unpack the story behind protein's rise and what it says about the cultural moment we find ourselves in. What inspired you to take a deeper look into this topic? What was it about protein that made you want to do a full exploration in this book?
Yeah, well, I was going to a gym in Kingston, and I was really struck by the fact that we were being encouraged to take protein, but also by the amount of space that what we call protein talk in the book took up, like the amount of oxygen that talking about how much protein, what kind of protein, before or after the workout, people should be consuming. And I thought that was really strange. This was like a private gym with, you know, middle and upper middle class people who all were pretty well fed and were wanting to add, in this case, it was mostly protein powder, that's like highly processed food, to their clean eating regimen. So that's what started me off. And then on the West Coast where Gavin was living, at the same time, he was training for a bunch of those mud running events and noticed a similar pattern among the people he was training with. And so we decided we were going to investigate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your book challenges a lot of common beliefs, or at least, you know, things that are being spoken about in popular culture right now. What's the biggest myth about protein you're hoping to debunk?
That we're not getting enough of it. So one of the points we make in the book is that if you have enough to eat, you're getting enough protein. Protein malnutrition only really happens among people who are severely malnourished because they don't have enough access to food or because they're very sick and very frail. And so the idea that you must supplement your meals with additional protein is, in fact, incorrect.
Mm-hmm. And you argue in this book that protein's popularity is driven more than just by nutrition. Mm-hmm. And I mean, as you've pointed out there, more than just the fact of whether or not people have enough. Mm-hmm. What forces are really behind its rise, do you think?
Yeah, that's a very big question. That's the book as a whole, really. I mean, one of the things that we write about is the longer history of protein supremacy. So this isn't new. It's perhaps the third or fourth protein boom, depending on how you splice it, since the mid-19th century when protein was identified as a category of nutrition. So we could return to that. But in terms of the present fixation, there are a number of things at work. I mean, one is that in the mid-20th century, there was a massive surplus of whey from dairy production as people stopped drinking as much milk, and dairy producers turned to making cheese instead. And when you make cheese, you have excess whey, and whey is extremely toxic if it's released into groundwater, rivers and streams, which is what farmers started doing because they had so much of the stuff and they needed to find a way to not do that anymore. And so whey powder, which is the most common form of protein powder, was a solution to that issue, to the issue of whey pollution. And then they needed to find a market for it. And so, you know, you see a ramping up of this idea that beyond just bodybuilding subcultures that you need additional protein. So that's one factor. The other factor we write about is optimization, right? So we live in a culture where every part of our lives, right, from sleep to work to food, is supposed to be optimized. And that's why I think this idea of supplemental protein, it isn't just about are you getting enough, it's are you getting the optimal amount, right, for longevity and good skin and muscle mass and strength and energy, even though protein is not the main source of the body's energy. And so we write about that, like the rise of optimization culture and the place of protein within that. And kind of at the root of that, I think, is this sense of existential precarity that we're all living with, right? The world is on fire, global war, cost of living crisis, and protein has come to be associated with a form of stability and strength in the context of all that turmoil.
Mm-hmm. And something simple you can control. And you don't have to think about all those other nutritional factors, just this one thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And you kind of touched on this there. And you and your co-author mm-hmm. both kind of noticed this in fitness spaces, maybe a particular demographic. I was wondering if you could speak to how protein is being marketed to different groups and maybe if there's any groups in particular that are really being targeted in this push.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about protein, we say that it's very adhesive and it can be attached to different, really diverse political projects and demographics. And so, you know, the original target audience for protein supplementation was definitely bodybuilders, serious gym rats, men mostly. And still, men make up the majority of protein powder supplement consumers. They consume far more than anyone else. You know, much of the market is devoted to enticing men to consume it. But what we've seen, especially in the last 3 or 4 years, is an increasing focus on the market for seniors who are sold protein with the idea that it will help you know, them to maintain their muscle mass as they age and fight sarcopenia, but also women, and especially menopausal women, of whom I am one, and this idea that you need protein to navigate menopause successfully and to ward off all the terrible side effects that many of us suffer from. I also noticed the other day when I was on the website for Jocko Fuel, Jocko Willink is a member of the muscular manosphere, an influencer in the U.S., has a podcast, sells a lot of supplements. He actually has a children's line now. So I think children are probably the next frontier in this protein boom.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if throughout your research, if there's anything you found that really surprised you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the longer history of protein and the fact that from the very beginning, it was tied to colonial and masculinist ideologies, and that from the very beginning, protein supplements were made from the excesses of industrial production. So I think both of those two things we didn't know going into the project. And to see that the science, the very basic early science of protein, was being driven by a concern about the, you know, newly industrializing, urbanizing manual labor force in Europe, about European military might overseas. We didn't know that, and it helps us trace a consistency through the years to the present moment, where protein consumption, for instance, is really tied to, you know, white nationalism and heteropatriarchy and a kind of MAGA Trumpian masculinity in the U.S. But I think, you know, far beyond that too. And that's one of the things we write about in the book, how protein supplementation and protein talk kind of helps spread particular ideas and ideologies, even among people who may not associate themselves with those far-right politics.
Mm-hmm. And you've touched on all of this, but I was wondering if you could dive a bit into those dangers of this push, because, mm-hmm. I mean, more than just, you know, buying expensive, highly processed protein powders, both nutritionally maybe and culturally for different groups, what are kind of the dangers here?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we're really trying to write against in the book is the reduction of food to nutrition and to its biochemical components. You know, what critics of this whole nutritionism. So what a fixation on protein or any other nutrient does to reduce the kind of pleasure and sociality of eating, let alone distract us from questions about climate. So that's one of the big themes in the book, is that it's really interesting that at this moment that there's a great deal of awareness and concern about a heating planet and the role of animal agriculture in that, industrial animal agriculture, that we're being encouraged to consume more protein. Now, some of that protein is plant-based, but we talk about the fact that, you know, meat may be in question in terms of its relationship to climate change, but not protein itself. Like, it remains untainted by those concerns. And so there are a few things that happen if you can happen if you consume too much protein. I mean, one of the things that I think people tend to forget is that you need to combine protein consumption with resistance training to build muscle. Otherwise, that protein just becomes fat. So and that's why it's actually consuming more protein is marketed both as a way to gain weight and to lose weight, right? It's a win-win for corporations because they can sell the same product to audiences with completely different opposing goals. The other thing that can happen is that you just pee it out, right? You use what you can and then the rest of it leaves your body. It can impact your kidneys. So people with kidney disease can't eat a lot of protein, but also eating too much protein can put a lot of pressure on your kidneys to process all that nitrogen. So we don't lean too heavily on that because you really have to go over the top to, which I guess people might be doing as we enter this protein maxing phase. We try to focus on the cultural and political and climate aspects of overconsumption, but there are certainly cautions that people should be aware of, and mostly just that you might be wasting your money because you can't actually process all this protein.
Mm-hmm. The tie-in with environment and everything is really interesting. Mm-hmm. I feel like, to me, everything just strikes me as a bid for control. That seems to be a really central concept here.
Absolutely, yeah. And this idea that very neoliberal individualist idea that you can't control anything but your own actions and you are in fact responsible for your own health. And I think in the world we're living in, that's unfortunately increasingly true, right? That we are not as a society looking after one another. And it makes sense that this idea that this taking the supplement will help you do that comes to make sense and becomes very persuasive.
Mm-hmm. And I was really curious, especially considering also mm-hmm. that you're working on a university campus, the arc is always bumping, mm-hmm. you work in kinesiology. What has been the response so far, both from, I don't know, maybe people online, but also folks in person who've chatted with you about this topic?
Yeah, I mean, one of the really interesting and kind of funny things that happens is that we present this work, and one of the big take-home messages is that we don't think people should be One of the big take-home messages is that we shouldn't all be fixated on our protein intake. We're getting enough. We're doing fine. Enjoy your food. But inevitably, at the end of a presentation, the first question will be, but how much protein should I eat, right? So it's really inside people's heads. I mean, it's even inside my head, right? I can't escape. I can't step outside of that ideology and that power relationship. So it's hard when I prepare my bowl of pasta with cheese for dinner to ignore this little voice in my head asking me where the protein is, right? So even when you're kind of actively trying to resist the discourse, it's there. And so we really notice that in the response. We also hear a lot of relief from people who feel like it gives them permission not to be fixated in this way. And also, of course, resistance, usually in the form of, you know, my science is better than your science. And the science is contested, right? So it's that's one of the points we make, is that we're not trying to identify a truth about protein. And actually, when earlier when I said, when I used the word incorrect, I really try to stay away from that. There's definitely a strong strain of nutritional science that says that the guidelines that we've been living with for decades, that the Trump administration has just increased, and Canada typically tends to follow the US guidelines, that those, the old protein recommendations were really based on what you need at a minimum and weren't based on optimization. And if we want to optimize, then we in fact should be taking as much as is recommended in these newer guidelines. But then there are just as many people on the other end of the spectrum who argue that we don't need, the minimum is sufficient. We don't need to be increasing our protein intake. The health benefits are unproven. It's bad for the environment, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like I know a few pieces of this answer, but what do you think this rhetoric should be replaced with? What is the healthy balance?
Enjoy your food. You know, if you're getting enough to eat, you're getting enough protein. And I think that's the thing. Like, I'm just really resistant to even talking about healthy balance because I want to move us away from this nutritionist relationship to our food. And this really messed up relationship to our bodies, right, that goes along with that. Like understanding our bodies as a kind of biochemical project or a machine to be tinkered with rather than something that we can enjoy,
you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what would you say for maybe people who are like athletes and have goals like that? Like, how should they be approaching this?
Yeah. So one of the things we argue in the book is that we are all being turned into elite athletes in relationship to our bodies, right? So there's this idea that if you get the right balance of nutrients and specifically the right amount of protein in your diet, that you'll have these fractional improvements in performance, right? Whatever your goal is, whatever your sport is. And the experts, you know, the elite performance nutrition experts, they point out that it's a really uncertain science. And the kind of work they do with Olympic athletes is very experimental, right? They don't like getting that right balance. It's very unclear what role nutrition ultimately plays. But if it plays a role, it's in these absolutely fractional improvements, you know, shaving point tenths of a second off your personal best, that kind of thing. So it's very interesting that we've become, a much broader public has become subject to that kind of disciplinary logic. We talk about that as the athleticization of, well, the athleticization of culture more broadly, and then as a subset of that, the athleticization of food culture.
Mm-hmm. And I did also want to ask, because you had your launch earlier this month in Kingston, how was that event?
It was amazing. Yeah, we packed the room. It was at the Broom Factory. I think we had 100 people there, and the capacity is right at 100. And there was a great vibe. And I think people were excited to learn about the work and to even for folks who aren't, have somehow escaped the protein fixation, to see that there are connections they can make between nutritional ideologies and the broader political moment in which we find ourselves.
Once again, that was Dr. Samantha King with some food for thought on protein, the making of a nutritional superstar. The book is available locally at Novel Idea Bookstore and online through Duke University Press. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.